With great power comes great responsibility.
Compromise where you can. Where you can't, don't. Even if everyone is telling you that something wrong is something right, even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye, and say, no, you move.
Never step onto the battlefield of ideas unprepared. Before you enter the fray, you need a plan. And there's no better place to get one than right here on Tactics with host Caleb Colquitt. The Situation Room goes live now on News Radio 1440.
Welcome in, everybody, and thank you so much for being with us, whether you're watching us on YouTube, Facebook Live, Twitter, Twitch, Periscope. However you're watching us, whatever venue you're watching us on, we certainly appreciate you making us a part of your day, especially since this is going to be our Memorial Day special. So welcome in for that. We do pay homage to those who have fallen, who have given the ultimate sacrifice for our liberties. And of course, that's something that we understand, and I'm guessing the vast majority of my audience already understands this, that it's always good to just give a little bit of a reminder that this is not Veterans Day. This is not a day to celebrate all those who have served. We certainly do celebrate all those who have served and appreciate their sacrifices. But Memorial Day is special. It is specifically carved out for those who have given the ultimate sacrifice, for those who gave their lives to defend our freedom. And to understand a little bit of history of that, this was actually started as Decoration Day. It was a day that ladies would go and decorate the graves and the headstones of fallen Confederate soldiers. And after some time, that transformed and it started to be expanded to all soldiers in general. And eventually we got to the point to where we have Memorial Day. So have a great time. Spend some time with your family, but don't forget to take a few moments out of today. And remember what this day is really about. Those soldiers who paid the ultimate price for our liberty. And in keeping with that sentiment, I would like to read this poem that I have here. And I don't know the author, but I saw it earlier and I think that it's very appropriate for this day. It is the soldier, not the minister, who has given us freedom of religion. It is the soldier, not the reporter, who has given us freedom of the press. It is the soldier, not the poet, who has given us freedom of speech. It is the soldier, not the campus organizer, who has given us the freedom to protest. It is the soldier, not the lawyer, who has given us the right to a fair trial. It is the soldier, not the politician, who has given us the right to vote. It is the soldier who salutes the flag, who serves beneath the flag, and whose coffin is draped by the flag, who allows the protester to burn the flag. Let all honor the fallen soldier and those who miss them. You know, on a technicality, I would point out that it is not soldiers that actually give us rights, but they're certainly the reason that we still have them protected. And what this poem really does is it points that out. That yes, we would have a God-given right to freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. We would have all of those things as rights ensured to us by God, regardless of what the soldier did. But because the soldiers do what they do, and because they are soldiers that give the ultimate sacrifice, then we have a government that protects those rights and does not seek to undermine those rights. And that is something that very few countries have, and something that we should continue to be grateful for. This poem emphasizes a profound truth, that the price of freedom is very steep. That the price of freedom is very high, but it is one that we are willing to pay. It is, I think, so offensive to those who have served and to those who have given their lives when people don't appreciate that freedom. And it's part of the reason, and I think it's because the left and the right tend to speak different languages, but it happens on both sides. But you know what I'm saying here, that there are certain people that talk about this country as though it's not a great place to live, as though it, from its very roots, is replete with oppression and evil and tyranny. And that's just not true. And it is a slap in the face to those who have sacrificed so much to say that that is true. Now, there might be a time where America does become tyrannical and does become incredibly oppressive and in significant ways undermines the liberty of its citizens. In certain ways, I believe that that has already happened in some limited quantities, and it's part of the reason that I do what I do. But to say that by the very root and the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, all of that is the fruit of a poison tree, that's simply not true. And there are soldiers that have given their lives to the defense of liberty in a very different way than soldiers of other countries do, because that's one thing that is a big difference and something that was very different in this country as opposed to others. There are many other nations that have their soldiers with a great deal of pomp and circumstance, and the citizens don't love the soldiers the same way they do, because the soldier is really a symbol of oppression. In America, they're a symbol of our liberty. In America, we understand that we are able to enjoy the freedoms that we do because of the sacrifices of our soldiers, and that's particularly important to remember on Memorial Day, because there are those among us who paid the ultimate price, who gave everything they had, who sacrificed their own lives so that others might taste that liberty. And that's why our soldiers are such a beloved figure in America in a way that they're really not in other countries in the world. Because even other countries that do have certain levels of freedom, what we would refer to as Western democracies, you know, I'm not saying that they're all terrible places to live or that their people are incredibly oppressed or anything, but it is different. For the longest time in the British Empire, the soldier was the people that kept the citizens in line and usually suppressed their liberties. The same thing was true of a lot of Western countries, and to some degree even is to this day. But it's not that way here. Here, the soldiers are a symbol of liberation because they stand in defense, not of a king, not even of a land, of an idea, of the Constitution of the United States, and the ideas behind it in the Declaration of Independence. That's why, in a very significant way, soldiers are different here than they are in other countries, and that's the reason that the American people treat them different and see them differently. You know, kind of to go along with that, one of my favorite songs, and I consider it my favorite patriotic song, but it's one of my favorite songs of all time, is Riding with Private Malone by David Ball, that kind of points this out. And if you're familiar with the story, it's about a kid that he is looking for a car, and he sees an ad in a paper, and he's just looking for some kind of junker. And when he pulls the cover off of this old car in a barn that this old lady has been hanging on to for a long time, it's a 66 Corvette, which, I mean, that's a classic car. It's an incredible find. And he winds up buying this car, and the car's his now. And after he has this car for a while, he opens up the glove box and finds this letter from a guy named Private Andrew Malone. And the chorus goes that if you're reading this, then I didn't make it home. But for every dream that shatters, another one comes true. This car was once a dream of mine, now it belongs to you. And though you may take her and make her your own, you'll always be riding with Private Malone. And it's a really great story. It's just a heartwarming American story. And eventually what happens is the guy, even though he says that he'd turn real quick and maybe see if there was somebody riding with him, he crashes the car one night. And there were witnesses, even though he doesn't remember anything about it, that said a soldier pulled him out and they were never able to find the soldier. And so the person that's singing the song, he says that he's convinced that the ghost or specter or whatever you want to call it of Private Malone saved his life. But what's really great about that song and what it really illustrates, I think the best line in the chorus is actually, "This car was once a dream of mine, now it belongs to you." The reason I think that's so powerful is because it illustrates something. It illustrates a truism about American life and about the way that we see our soldiers and those that are willing to pay the ultimate price like Private Malone did in the story. You see, there are people that gave up their lives and, effectively, their dreams. Each soldier that has given his life, he had plans for the future. He had things that he thought about doing. Maybe somebody special that he wanted to marry. Maybe kids that he left behind and he wanted to see them grow up. It's a really sobering thought to think that there is not just one person, but thousands upon thousands of soldiers over the years that have given up their futures so that others might have a better future, so that others might enjoy the liberty that over 200 years of Americans have enjoyed now, that they were willing to give up their dreams so that the rest of us would have an opportunity to pursue ours. We're going to go to a break. We'll be back in just a minute.
And now for a reading from the Social Justice Warrior Bible with Pastor Gregory Post.
Welcome in. I'm Gregory Post, head pastor at the Eternal Living Word Transdenominational Community Church and Coffee House in Novato, California. Now it's time for a reading from the SJW Bible. Today's reading will come from Leviticus chapter 10, verses 1 through 10. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took their respective fire pans, and after putting the fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. And the fire came out of the presence of the Lord, which created a wicked cool light show for them to see and totally got everyone feeling the Spirit's presence. Then Moses said to Aaron, "It is what the Lord spoke, saying, 'Even though I didn't command you to use this strange fire, I totally understand your need to express yourselves in worship and keep yourselves entertained.' So Aaron therefore danced and yelled with joy, knowing that his sons were having a good time at worship. Moses called out to Mishael and Ezaphan, and the son of Aaron's uncle Uzziel, and said to them, 'Come forward, carry your relatives away in front of the sanctuary outside of the camp, for they have fainted from being overwhelmed by the power of God's coolness.' So they came forward and carried them still in their tunics outside the camp, as Moses had said. Then Moses said to Aaron and his sons Eleazar and Ithamar, 'Do not uncover your heads nor tear your clothes, because God wants us to always be happy, and as long as we're happy, he's happy. Therefore, if worship doesn't give you an overwhelming sense of euphoria, you need to find another congregation, preferably one with a more dynamic pastor and band.' So they did according to the word of Moses. And the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, 'Do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you, when you come into the sanctuary, so that you will be able to drink more once you arrive. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations, and so as to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, between the unclean and the clean, because when worship stops being fun or feels judgy, then it becomes profane and unclean.'" Wow, so inspiring. This has been a reading from the SJW Bible. And remember, the only truth that matters is your truth.
Welcome back, all. Thank you so much for being with us. And there is more local news actually to get to that I didn't know if we were going to be able to get to it, but got to tell you, it is an interesting thing to see Alabama in the national news so consistently over and over again for the past really about 2 weeks. But of course, it has to do with the whole abortion ban is the reason this is going on. But it gets to a deeper issue, and I want you to really pay attention to this. There's a clip of Ilhan Omar. She's a freshman senator and also a practicing devout Muslim. That's the reason that she wears the hijab and has the whole head covering thing going on while she's serving there in the halls of Congress. And keep in mind that she is a refugee, I believe, from Somalia, if I'm not mistaken. So let's go ahead and take a look at this clip from the Congresswoman talking about our state.
Religious fundamentalists are currently trying to manipulate state laws in order to impose their beliefs on an entire society, all with complete disregard for voices and the rights of American women. Their recent efforts, like those in Alabama, in Georgia, are only the latest in a long history of efforts to criminalize women for simply existing, to punish us when we don't conform to their attempts to control us. But because it's happening here with the support of the ultra-conservative religious right, we call it religious freedom. It's simply unthinkable. Let's just be honest. For the religious right, this isn't simply about their care or concern for life. If they cared about or were concerned about children, they would be concerned about the children that are being detained and those that are dying in camps across our borders. Or the children who are languishing in hunger and facing homelessness. This isn't about religious morality or conviction, because we've seen time and time again those that talk about their faith and want to push policies because of their faith are the ones that simply are caught with the hypocrisy of not living it out in their personal lives. I am frustrated every single time I hear people speaking about their faith and pushing that onto other people. Because we know those so-called religious politicians, when it comes to their life, their choices, they want to talk about freedom. But when it comes to other people's lives and other people's choices, they want to talk about religion.
All right, so that again is the execrable Ilhan Omar going after the state of Alabama. First of all, just a quick observation. Omar is a garbage speaker. As a public speaker, she is awful. And there are people on the left that are really good at public speaking. I mean, Barack Obama is as good an orator as you will ever find. His policies are terrible. Usually I disagree with almost everything that he's actually saying, the content of his speech, but the man is a masterful orator. Not as good as Ronald Reagan, and he does get a little tripped up when he doesn't have a teleprompter. But the point is, the man is still a talented speaker, and he knows how to work an audience. Joe Biden is actually oddly really good at this as well. Bill Clinton, nobody better than Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, I think, is actually ahead of Obama. I mean, that guy is just excellent in a room full of people. He's pretty good on camera, but I mean, the guy is really, really good in front of a room full of people. Ilhan Omar, she does not have it. Because you'll notice if you're watching that clip, and I say this is somebody that spends a great deal of his time preparing remarks and then delivering them to people. This is my job. I do it every single day. That Ilhan Omar, she has to look down, look up, look down, look up, look down, look up. I mean, it happens all the time, and she has to read everything word for word. Whenever she reaches the end of what she was saying, she has to look back down and then talk about it and look back up. Keep in mind, this happens in the general speeches portion of Congress. In other words, she wasn't debating a specific bill. She was making a general speech, which means she was allotted 5 minutes. in 5 minutes' time, she couldn't even memorize her speech enough, and she has to do it verbatim. She has to do it right off the manuscript. That's why she gets tripped up and gets very, very pointed about making sure that she says every word correct. For example, you'll notice there she said woman's, and then she said women's right to exist. See, she read it as plural as opposed to possessive, and it tripped her up. And she had to go back and correct herself because she knows the rest of the sentence will be grammatically incorrect if she doesn't. She can't ad-lib. She's not quick on her feet. She's really not that bright. She's just reading things off of a script. And you can tell she not only doesn't know her speech, that she cannot deviate from the script at all. She has to read everything word for word because she can't really think that quickly when she's up there and having to actually communicate with people. And again, this is a 5 minute speech. I was literally giving 5 minute speeches, actually speeches longer than 5 minutes, since I was, about 11 or 12. And by the way, just to give you a example of this, these are my notes for the show. These two pages. And then that poem that I read at the top of the show. This will keep me going for an hour, maybe an hour and a half. Just an outline. Nothing special, nothing fancy. You can see them right there. That's my notes for an hour-long show. And I'm not perfect. I have to look down sometimes. If I have to read a quote or I have to read a Bible verse, I have to look down to make sure that I get it right because I want to get it accurate. Ilhan Omar is writing her own words. She's not doing a direct quote from somebody. And she can't really go more than about 5 or 6 words without looking back at her speech and looking up and looking back at her speech and looking up. This is not a bright woman. And I'm not saying that she's a complete idiot, or there aren't certain things that she does know, but I'm just saying, as a speaker, she sucks. And because of her speaking style, you can tell that she cannot think on her feet very quickly. She is not good at being able to riff or ad-lib. Now, as much as I know that there are people on the left that hate Donald Trump, the man's a heck of a communicator. You may not like the things that he's saying, but he's actually pretty good at communicating. The content, yeah, it leaves something to be desired. But as far as being able to get in front of a crowd, relate to a crowd, converse back and forth with them, he can do that. So now let's actually get into the content of what she was saying in her attacks on her state. So first of all, and this was the main thing, she kept saying that because the religious right is the one pushing these abortion bans, we call it religious liberty. Who calls it that? Who? Can you cite somebody? Seriously, because religious liberty is a really big deal to me. I think that anybody that's been any time watching this program or following my career understands that pretty well. I'm a minister. I take religious liberty very seriously. I do not know a single person that is saying because of religious liberty, abortions ought to be banned. I know very few people, even though they do exist, that are saying because my religion teaches abortion is wrong, then abortion should be banned. There are at least that, but what she's saying here is the people are saying we need to ban abortions because of religious liberty. No, no one's saying that. You're strawmanning here. There is nobody that I'm aware of, no serious person on the right whatsoever, whether you're talking about politicians, whether you're talking about pundits or commentators like myself, I do not know of any single person on the right that is saying religious liberty, therefore we should ban abortion. That doesn't even make sense. Even if you believe that your abortion, that your religion taught against abortion, and that was the basis for you saying that it should be illegal, that's still technically not religious liberty. And so I don't really get what she's going for here. Religious liberty is the ability for you to practice your religion and to not be inhibited by the government in doing so. It says nothing about things like abortion. That's not religious liberty. Even if you said the only reason that I am against abortion being legal is because of religion, that still wouldn't be religious liberty. And so I'm really confused by her saying that religious liberty specifically is the rationale being used to push the bans on abortion, because I don't know of anybody that's making that case. And I've said for a long time, even if I were an atheist, I would still be against abortion. Now, of course, I believe that my faith teaches that abortion is wrong. I'm not saying that that's not the case. You can make a biblical case for abortion being an immoral thing to do. But whether or not I believed in the Bible, I would still absolutely be against abortion. Because as long as you start from the assumption that human life is important, which, by the way, is the basis for our entire system of government, that among these are life, first one, liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Kind of hard to have liberty or pursue happiness if you're dead. So the right to a person being able to live, and my understanding that the person in the womb, based on my understanding of biology, that is completely independent of my religion. Now, of course, I believe my religion also says that it's wrong. But I would believe that abortion is wrong for the same reason that I believe that murder is wrong. If I became an atheist, I wouldn't say, well, you know what, we should just be able to murder everybody. No, wouldn't say that. And in the same way, if all of a sudden I just became an atheist tomorrow, not going to happen, but if that were to take place, I would still be against abortion. My stance on abortion would not change because of that. You would have to change my idea about what constitutes a human being. That would be the only way that you could change my stance on abortion. My religion is not the reason, and it's not the sole reason, but it's not even the primary reason that I think that abortion should be illegal. But nonetheless, there we are. They're continuing to try to push this narrative that the only people that are against abortion are religious zealots, and they're trying to push their religion on other people. Again, has nothing to do with pushing my religion. I don't believe in pushing my religion on other people through a legal process. I don't believe that we should be a theocracy. And even so, even if my religion went away completely, still not for abortion. That's a myth that they've been pushing for years. And I even know atheists that are pro-life. A great example was Austin Peterson, the one that ran for the Libertarian presidential candidate this last time. Lost to Gary Johnson, but still, he ran. The guy's an atheist, also pro-life. You do not have to be a religious person to believe that we should be protecting children in the womb. It's just the way it is. Furthermore, I would like to point out that she, in her criticism, is pointing out a very strong contrast between Christianity and Islam. Because she is saying, I'm not saying this, she, as a Muslim woman, is saying that if Christians were living out their faith, then hungry children would be taken care of. Now, there is a bit of a logical fallacy taking place when she's saying that there are hungry kids still in existence, ergo Christians aren't really doing what they're supposed to be doing. Because even the teaching of the scripture says that Christ said to his apostles, the poor you will have with you always. So even if Christians are doing their best and doing their job, hungry people are still going to exist. Saying that, well, Christianity obviously doesn't work because there is still one child in the world that is hungry, yeah, that's not really an argument against Christians actually living out their faith. Christ says that even if we do that, that there's still going to be need, that there is going to always be more need than there is people willing to do good and help out. So that's not really evidence against Christianity, but what she's saying there is, if Christians were living out their faith, that's her assumption, that what we would be doing is taking care of needy children, which is accurate. This is something that is specifically commanded of us in the scripture. Think about that, because the contrast is, if Muslims live out their faith, we've seen what that looks like. We've seen that that ends with people being burned alive in cages, and people being beheaded, and underage girls being raped multiple times merely because they're not Muslim. I mean, horrific, awful things on the level of the Holocaust. When Muslims put their faith into practice and actually live by the Quran, that's what that looks like. When Christians put their faith into practice and do what their religion commands, even Ilhan Omar asserts that what that looks like is children being fed and taken care of. It really is a remarkable thing that she doesn't see the contrast that she herself is actually making. But it's important to note here in that contrast that Christianity at no point ever calls for a theocracy. Islam does. You see, whether you're talking about the Jewish religion, which is just incomplete Christianity, I'm not saying that the Jews are on par with the Muslims or anything. I'm just saying that if you're looking at the Jewish faith, it's a theocracy. It is a law that is built for a people in an earthly kingdom with an established land. The same is true for Islam. Islam has a physical land and has laws accompanying it that are supposed to govern a worldly nation. Christianity specifically does the opposite of that. Christ had the option a couple of times to become a king or have some kind of worldly kingdom. He did not. He specifically said that his kingdom is not of this world. Christians are not trying to create a theocracy. And when it comes to the abortion thing, that's not a part of that. Abortion is certainly wrong according to the scripture, but that's, again, not the reason that I think that it ought to be illegal. That's not the reason, it's not the only reason, that I am pro-life. And so, it really makes no sense, the argument that she's making here. And my question to that would be, since Christianity doesn't call for theocracy, but Islam and Judaism both do, who's really pushing their faith? Now, there were laws for the Jews when strangers were to come into their land. They were supposed to treat them well, be kind to them, because God told them to remember that they had been sojourners in Egypt. They had been strangers in a foreign land when they were in Egypt. And so, sort of the golden rule applying there, when you have foreigners in your land, you don't give them the full benefits of Judaism just yet, but you do treat them well. Christianity has no theocracy. It just says, treat everybody well. Everybody's your neighbor. What does Islam do? If you're a foreigner, under the rules stated in the Quran, you have three options. You can kill them, you can tax them, or you can subdue them and make them slaves. Let's not pretend that this is the same thing. And so when you're looking at this and talking about, well, they're pushing their faith. Yeah, well, Christians are not trying to push their faith on other people. They're saying that this is a human life, ergo it should be protected. That's not pushing your faith on another person. The Jews were commanded specifically that they were supposed to treat foreigners well, even if they didn't share their faith and they weren't supposed to marry into somebody who believed in pagan ideals. They were not commanded to specifically destroy foreigners that didn't share their faith that were living inside the land of Israel. Muslims are specifically commanded to either convert them to Islam or to kill them, tax them, or make them into slaves. Who's the religion that's pushing their faith on other people in light of that? And here's another thing that she says too. She says, this is just about them trying to control women. This is just about them trying to control you. All people that are pro-life are saying, all that is being said here is, if your bad decision does not justify harming another person. That's all we're saying. Like I've said before, I'm not trying to control a woman's body. I'm wanting her to control her own body and a man to control his own body so that unwanted pregnancies don't happen, that they do things responsibly. But if they do choose, if they do make a choice, and I think that they should be free to make that choice, even if it's a bad decision, that you're free to make that choice, but you also have to live with the consequences. That you also have to live with the outcome of your choices. You're free to make bad decisions if you want, but you bear that responsibility. And you making a bad decision and acting irresponsibly is not a justification for hurting another person. For example, let's take drunk driving. Let's apply Ilhan Omar's logic to drunk driving. How dare you try to control my body? I'm putting the alcohol in my body, and then I'm taking my car and driving it home. How dare you try to control me? Well, the reason we're not trying to control you, we're just saying that if you made a bad decision to get drunk, and if you made a much worse decision to drive while drunk, then yes, we are going to penalize and arrest you because you broke the law and did something that could hurt another person. You see, once you involve another person, then all of a sudden, your freedom has to take a back seat. If you are acting recklessly in a way that is very likely to harm another person, then the law has to say, nope, you can't just act recklessly like that. You can't make bad decisions if they're going to hurt someone else. And keep in mind, in the analogy of drunk driving, This is just something that is likely to harm somebody else. In an abortion, every successful abortion ends in a death. Every single time. And unfortunately, there are now people like the governor of Virginia that are saying, even in an unsuccessful abortion where someone actually winds up living, then we should still be able to consider maybe we killed them then when we didn't succeed the first time trying to kill them. We are living in a very dark time where the sanctity of life has just been completely thrown out of the way. So finally, let's get to her final claim. That Christians don't really believe what they believe, or they would be helping kids at the border and helping hungry kids. That's really the crux of what she's claiming here. But here's the truth. This is an obvious attempt, a very obvious, blatant attempt, to try to obscure the fact that they don't care about kids. This is a red herring fallacy. What she's trying to do is she's throwing this out here to try to distract from the fact that they don't care whether the children in the womb live or die. That's what's happening. She's trying to throw that out there so you can distract from the fact that they're saying, we think you should be able to kill the kids in the womb. That's the only reason they're bringing this up. But even if you believe the kids in cages narrative, which we've debunked several times, we'll talk about it a little bit in a second. Even if you believe this narrative that there were no cages beforehand, everybody was fine, immigrants were coming in, they were being treated well, there was no problems, and all the kids were living in mansions while they were waiting on their court hearings. Even if you believe that ridiculous piece of fiction, and then big bad Trump came in, and he said, you know what, we're going to put them in cages and feed them like dogs, which is not what happened. He continued the policies of the previous administration. But anyway, even if you believe that stupid narrative that is easily disprovable, even if you thought that was true, it's still not killing kids. Treating them badly? Yes. Would that be a bad thing? Sure. Are they being murdered? No. And so let's not treat these things as though it's a one-to-one comparison. Even if you ignore the fact that it's a complete red herring fallacy, even if you ignore the fact that this entire narrative is based on lies, based on this idea that Trump changed things from the way that they were before Obama was, and that they are really being treated inhumanely, even if you believe that fiction, there's still a big difference between mistreating children and killing children. There is a variation there. There is an argument of degrees to be made there. And when it comes to the whole kids in cages thing, look, if you wanted to, you could go to virtually any school in America. And if you strategically took a picture in a certain way, you could make it look like horrible conditions. For example, at my school in particular, there was a little caged off area that had a little garden. And it was locked with a deadbolt. I used to go there and play pretty much every day that my dad had to stay late, which was pretty often because he was a teacher. And so I'd have to stay for maybe 15-20 minutes after school let out. The thing is, that gate wasn't real secure, and I could slip on in there. And it was an overgrown area, it wasn't well kept, there was grass and weeds growing out there. It probably wasn't all that safe for me to play there, to be honest. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, waist-high grass or anything, but it was just this little area that I would go and play sometimes with my sister, and we would go off there, and I could pull the gate open because the deadbolt latch didn't go very far in, and I could pull it open and pull it shut. Now, if any random photographer had been walking by and seen me and my sister in this tiny little caged-in area with a deadbolt on it to where it looks like we could not get out, and had taken a picture of us in there, you could run a headline with that picture saying, local school locks children in secluded area. And it would look bad. It would look real bad. But what the person looking at that picture doesn't know is I can get out anytime I want to. All I have to do is pull the latch a certain way, door comes free. And they also wouldn't know that I'm the one that got in there in the first place. I intentionally wanted to go into that area, which is why I was in there and why I closed the door behind me. You see, my point in all this is pictures, though they're helpful, can be deceiving. And a lot of these pictures that we're seeing going around the internet, if you look behind the kids, they actually have a pretty big open area. They're not being kept in this one tiny little cage. A lot of the times, these things are just barriers to section off different groups of the kids. And you also have to remember that you're dealing with a group of kids that pretty much exclusively speak Spanish or another language. And keeping track of them is very difficult. And you're also dealing with the fact that they're working with limited funding, largely due to the Democrats, I might add. And so they're having to do the best that they can to throw this stuff together to stem the tide that's going through there. If you have 1,000 extra kids show up one particular day, you can't just build the building instantly. This isn't Fortnite or some kind of like Roller Coaster Tycoon or something, or Age of Empires, where you can just build a new structure in 15 seconds. And so, yes, these pictures exist, but they don't tell the whole story. Perfect example of that is when we saw the pictures of the mom fleeing the tear gas with the two kids, some of them in diapers. But what people didn't stop to ask was, well, those kids are actually way too old to be in diapers in the first place, and it turns out that the people that were running the caravan orchestrated that picture. That they specifically sent moms with babies to the front in that first group so that they could get the photo op that they wanted. Or the little girl in the pink, a pink suit or a pink coat that Time Magazine had with a Photoshop Donald Trump looking over her. That they were saying, oh, these crying children at the border that have been separated from their parents, who found out the mom was actually standing right next to her. That this little girl hadn't been separated from her parents. Her mom set her down for a second to sign a paper to get a court hearing. And it turns out that little girl was not very far from her mother at all. And yet this was used as the big picture of child separation when really it wasn't. And so when you're looking at this, just keep in mind that these pictures can be deceiving. Doesn't mean they always are. Doesn't mean there's not really a crisis at the border, because I believe there is. Back in 2014, which, by the way, who is that dude that was president back then? Oh, yeah, Barack Obama. There was an influx of immigrants coming through in 2014. There were so many that they were running out of beds, they were having trouble feeding them, and so we raised, and by we I mean Mercury One, I did some work with them, that's Glenn Beck's organization, me and other American Christians, many of whom do not agree with open borders and want there to be a wall and extra security measures and to stop the influx of illegal immigration. Many of us, even though we believe that, gave a lot of our own hard-earned money to get teddy bears and soccer balls and meals to these kids, because they were in violation of the law, or their parents told them to do that, or their parents brought them over here, it doesn't mean we don't care about the kids. And that's another thing that the left refuses to talk about. That there have been multiple efforts by people, even on the right, conservative religious Americans, that have done a lot to help these kids out. There are churches on the border right now helping these kids out. That doesn't mean you don't care about the kids. And we've got to quit playing this game of, if you're not in favor of full-on open borders, then it's because you hate children. No, that's not it. Just because we want our laws to be obeyed does not mean we have any animosity for the people that want to break the law. We don't want them to break the law, obviously. We want to hold them accountable for their actions. But that's not the same thing as saying you hate the person on the other side. The reason that we want armed robbery, for example, to be illegal is not because we hate people that may consider armed robbery. It's because we care about the people in our family and in our home that could be hurt. And that's something that the left continues to intentionally ignore, especially when you consider that they were not outraged about these exact same policies happening when it was President Barack Obama doing it. See, now they're saying, oh, this is intentional, and it's all because of racism. It's because Trump hates immigrant children, and he hates brown kids. But when it was Barack Obama doing exactly the same thing, they didn't say anything about it. You see, what's funny about all this is a lot of these problems that they're bringing up, They are the result. They are the offspring, as it were, of bad liberal policies. There are a lot of leftist judges and an awful lot of leftist Democrats in Congress like her that opposed extra spending at the border, beefing up security, the security measures that would keep more kids from coming in so that we could get the ones that we have here now under control, and extra funding for the facilities down there. You see, the Democrats want it to look bad. They want it to look overcrowded. They want it to look inhumane because that scores political points from them. And what have they been doing since then? Blocking funds to these facilities. They don't care about the kids. They care about a political win. And it absolutely disgusts me that somebody like Ilhan Omar is trying to blame the right when it's her party and their policies that have been causing the crisis in the first place. Think about this. Under the worldview, under the design, under the desire, the policy recommendations of those on the right, these kids would never be put in these facilities in the first place because they would still be, by the way, not separated with their families in their home country. And if they want to come to America, by all means, apply. Do it through legal channels. That's all we're asking for. That is all we're saying. They're trying to conflate this with hatred of the kids, and it's just not. You see, it's the sanctuary cities and the generous benefits that are drawing the families here in the first place. It's the Democrat policies that caused this problem. And they refuse to clean it up because they think that they can score a political win from it. They don't mind who they hurt, as long as they win when it comes to politics. The best thing that could happen for these kids is to secure the border and to fund ICE and to fund the Border Patrol the way that they should be. That's what's actually going to help the kids. And for Ilhan Omar to say, well, you religious people, you just care about children in the womb and you don't care about the children of the border. No, we care about both. You're the one that doesn't. Let's go to the Daily Dose of Stupid.
That was stupid.
I know it was stupid.
Really stupid.
Hey, I just said it was stupid.
Today's Daily Dose of Stupid, and this one is actually a lot of fun. There was a survey taken of Americans about Arabic numerals. And this is a group called Civic Science, which conducted a survey of about 3,600 people asking if Arabic numerals should be taught in schools. So for those of you who are unaware, Arabic numerals are the numerals that we use every single day. 1, 2, 3, 4, that's an Arabic numeral. In fact, a lot of modern mathematics is based and predicated upon the mathematical system that was developed in the Middle East. And so Arabic numerals, as opposed to, for example, Roman numerals, those are the ones that we use every single day. And in this survey, you're going to love this. 56% said, no, we shouldn't teach them. 29% said yes, 15% had no opinion. So that means only 29% of the American population thinks that we ought to be teaching math with actual numerals, the numerals that they're using currently. Okay, so this is, I think, pretty amusing because we do use this system every day, but it's kind of like the dihydrogen oxide joke if you've ever seen it. And there are entire families of memes and entire websites now dedicated to the dihydrogen oxide thing. So dihydrogen oxide is the chemical name of water because it's two hydrogen atoms, one oxygen atom. So you put that together, dihydrogen oxide, it's water. But they'll say goofy things like, well, dihydrogen oxide is sprayed on plants to make them grow. And they grow much larger with this, where dihydrogen oxide can burn you in its gaseous state, which it can because steam can burn you. Or the primary component of acid rain is dihydrogen oxide, you know, stuff like that. And so the joke is that they can make something that's completely harmless sound really bad if said in a certain way. And that's exactly what's going on here, is people hear Arabic numerals. Oh, no, we shouldn't be teaching Arabic numerals. We should be teaching American numerals. Well, Arabic numerals are the ones that Americans use. So, yeah, we're learning using Arabic numerals. In fact, the little News Radio 1440, we're using Arabic numerals, 1440. So there you go. We use those every single day. But anyway, the whole thing's funny, but some people, I think, misinterpreted this or took it too far. We're going to look at a tweet from the CEO of the organization that actually put this on. The guy's name is John Dick, who says, "Ladies and gentlemen, the saddest and funniest testament to American bigotry we've ever seen in our data." All right, so here's the thing. Is it hilarious? Yes. It's something that really amused me. But the idea that this guy who runs the company is saying that this is a testament to American bigotry. Okay, first of all, the word bigotry gets thrown out an awful lot. So let's actually define what bigotry is. Webster's Dictionary defines it as obstinate or intolerant devotion to one's own opinions and prejudices. So you're saying that all the people that said, no, we shouldn't be teaching Arabic numerals to our kids, that they're bigots. No, that's not what's going on here. The reason they thought that is because they figured it was some useless piece of random knowledge that was being suggested to be taught to students, even though it would be worthless just because it's multicultural. And let's be honest, with the history of the education system and some of the things they do teach in school, are they really that far off by thinking that that was a possibility? I would say no. If they had known that Arabic numerals are the ones that we use every day, I'm guessing that it would have been like probably 99%, because for whatever reason, nobody agrees on 100%. But if they had known that that was the numerals that we were talking about, it would have been 99% saying yes. The reason they didn't is because they didn't know what it actually was. See, if they had known, even if they knew that those numerals did originate in the Middle East, they would have been fine with it. Which proves what? The opposite. That even though maybe in their mind they did think that generally things that come from the Middle East are bad, if you say, well, actually the numeric system that we use, the numerals that we use in our mathematics, those actually originate in the Middle East, the vast majority of people would go, oh, okay, well that's fine then. You see, the thing is, he's saying that it's bigotry, but if they were told that, I'm guessing the vast majority of these people that said no would say, oh, all right, that's fine. So in other words, you present them with new information that they didn't have before, and then they change their mind, which would make them the opposite of a bigot. See, a bigot would be somebody that if they really did have this strong aversion to this, that they said, you know what, we should use Arabic numerals. And you said, no, we shouldn't do that. And you say, well, the thing is, the numerals that we use right now are Arabic numerals. Okay, if you say that, and then they do know that, and then they say, well, you know what, since that came from the Middle East, then we shouldn't be teaching it then. We need to come up with a new numeric system. Okay, that person's a bigot. If that's the reaction that you get, fine. That person is actually a bigot. But if you're talking about people that can be presented with new information and have their mind changed, then it's actually the opposite of bigotry. It's actually the exact opposite of what this guy was tweeting. So here's the thing. They're not against multiculturalism. They're against multiculturalism for the sake of multiculturalism. If you're talking about the battlefield of ideas, if you're talking about just good ideas that happen to benefit everybody, people don't really care where they come from. There's a reason people love eating at Mexican restaurants and Asian restaurants. There's a reason that people don't have a problem with driving a foreign car or buying things from other countries, even when they know that it was developed in another country, even when they understand that it's not American. Why? Because as long as it's a good idea, they don't care. What they have a problem with, and what I'm guessing most of the people that said no in this survey were thinking, is they don't like multiculturalism for the sake of multiculturalism. In other words, buying a car or a phone or a laptop or being taught something in school, even though it's worthless and it's not going to be something that is applicable to their life, simply because it happens to be from another culture. Look, let the best idea win. That's all I'm asking. That's all I'm asking. The Aramaic numeral system works very well, and that's the reason I'd like to hold on to it. Not because it's Aramaic, not because it's American, because it's the best idea. That's what's so great about a free market. The best ideas rise to the top. It is the ultimate public opinion survey that people will go along with a good idea regardless of where it came from, regardless of the cultural context surrounding it. They will go with the best idea that makes their lives easier, which is the way that it ought to work. Regardless of what culture you're from, the best idea should be the one that gets used. And that is the opposite of bigotry. So this guy, look, it's a funny joke. You got him. You got the people that said no on it. You can revel in that. You can take pride in that. That's fun. We can all have a good laugh about it. Don't make it into more than it is. Don't try to make it into some kind of testament to how close-minded Americans are. Because the vast majority of them, if you had told them that that's the ones that we use every day, they'd be perfectly fine with it. Which, again, if you can be presented with new information and then change your opinion, that's the opposite of bigotry. Chaplin's report is next.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
Chaplain's report today does come from the book of Ephesians. We're going to take a little break in our look into the book of Daniel, just because, if nothing else, it is Memorial Day. And because it is Memorial Day, I thought that it was important that we do something a little special to remember those that have given everything that they had. So since it's Memorial Day, I thought it was only appropriate we take a second to talk about sacrifice, real sacrifice, based on love. And when you know that you're not going to get anything in return, or at least you're very unlikely to. Let's talk about that kind of sacrifice, because in the book of Ephesians, chapter 5, verses 1 through 2, it says, "Therefore be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma." Now, it's true that none of us even have the ability or the capacity to give the way Christ gave, to give in the way that he did, because he left a throne in glory and intentionally gave himself up to be killed for the lives of others. There is no greater sacrifice than that. No human can sacrifice that way. We just don't have that ability because we don't have that option. Christ did. But what I want to draw your attention to is the first part of verse 1. You see, we're supposed to be imitators of God. In other words, as his children, as people with a spark of that divine in us that are trying to follow in that image of our God and Creator, we need to be the kind of people that look up and try to do what God does. And knowing that God is the kind of God that sends his own son to die on a cross to have us forgiven of our sins, and that God is also the son that came to redeem us of those sins and willing to give his own life to die for us, then to be an imitator of God is to be a person that has sacrificial love. And certainly, soldiers on the battlefield that are willing to risk and in the cases that we're talking about with Memorial Day, give their own lives, that would be a sacrificial love at least similar to the sacrificial love that God has, but it's something that we're all called to do. Not all of us can fight. Not all of us have the ability or the knowledge or the skill or whatever to go out on a battlefield and defend our country and to defend other people in that way. But regardless of what we do, regardless of what our calling is, we are all called to be imitators of God, to do things that we think that God would do, to try to conform our will and our personality to be obedient to Him, to be more like Him, to be more Christ-like. That is a call that reaches to every person. Not just soldiers, not just people that are willing to literally give their physical lives, because we are all called to give our lives to God. Not to just die for Him, but to also live for Him. And when he's talking about the sacrificial love to be literal death, literal dying in the physical sense, I think that there's something to be said for that, because obviously not everybody has to make that choice, and thank God for that. But I think anybody that is wanting to call themselves a follower of Christ has to at least be willing to do that. We've seen it in the martyrs all throughout the biblical narrative, that God expects those who follow Him to be able to give their own lives for His cause. Not all of us are called to do that, but all of us are expected to. And in a lot of ways, that's not too dissimilar from a soldier. Not every soldier dies in battle. Not every single one does have to give that ultimate sacrifice. But every single one is expected to. And if we are going to be soldiers in God's army, and if we are going to be imitators of our Heavenly Father the way that Ephesians 5, 1 and 2 describes, then we are going to be imitators of God in the sense that we would be willing to give that ultimate sacrifice. And you'll notice that in the latter part of that verse, what Paul is talking about is walking in love, as Christ also did, and then gave Himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice. Which means that this is exactly what he's talking about. That kind of sacrificial love, that Christ walked in love all of His life and then eventually gave that ultimate sacrifice in behalf of God, that's what imitating Christ looks like. That's what imitating God is supposed to be. Having that sacrificial love that we live for one another, that we give of ourselves every single day, and that if we ever have to make that sacrifice, we're willing to. We count it but loss. You know, I've thought about this a lot. And if we're called to be imitators of God, I don't think all of us have to literally give our lives. But I do think, based on this scripture, based on this text, that that willingness is not only an important part of it, but that we are called to sacrifice in some way, or we're not imitating Him at all. So my question is, and I want this to stick with you, and I want you to really mull this over, because I know that I have for a while, and I still don't have a perfect answer. What are you sacrificing? Think about that. Because if you're living a life where you can't honestly say, I am sacrificing X for the cause of Christ, I don't think you're imitating God. And I'm not saying that to convict people. I got to be honest, there's times where I don't really think I'm sacrificing anything. Where I question, am I really giving up things for God? Am I really inconveniencing myself? Am I really putting what I want on hold to do what God wants me to do? Because there's a lot of times where I don't think I am. And I just want you to remember that. That if you, and I'm preaching to myself here, that if you are not doing something, that you are giving something up, something that you want, something that you would rather have, but you're willing to forego for the cause of Christ, are you really being an imitator of God? Can you really call yourself a follower of Jesus Christ if you are not doing that every single day of your life? Because I don't know that you can. I don't know that you can call yourself a Christian if that's the case. And that's the reason that, frankly, sometimes I'm scared that I don't have a good answer for that question. It's something that we need to work towards every single day. If we want to really walk in love the way that Paul is talking about here, it's something that we need to consider and we need to be constantly aware of. So as we spend this important day of Memorial Day remembering the sacrifices that others have made, let's also remember to ask ourselves as Christians and as followers of our Lord and Savior, what are we sacrificing for what we believe in? Stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media, Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.